This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week, it's a taste of the sea with Mark experiencing his very own cold dip in Aberdeen.
Out of Doors with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Stick with me on this because this is likely to get confusing. The sun is shining and it's blue skies here in Aberdeen, but earlier this week I was actually down in Ayrshire in Irvine on the beach. Beautiful, beautiful morning. You know, you're looking right across to the islands and caps of cloud on tops of the hills and things. But the one thing that I take away from Irvine is that turnstones, little birds of the beach, run about in the car park in Tesco's. Isn't that just lovely? Morning, I'm Mark Stephen. Right beside me here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, Rachel Stewart.
It is a gorgeous morning. It was so nice to open the door at 5 o'clock to daylight and a gorgeous pink sky, a wee covering of crunchy frost as well, enough to remind me not to get too carried away in the garden.
No.
Tempting as it is.
But we didn't have the crunchy frost, but it was skeins of mist and things.
Yeah. Beautiful morning, really beautiful, and a really striking moon as well.
Yes. Very nice.
And of course, it's kind of the start of the tourism season, isn't it? Easter weekend is usually the start of it in Scotland. So let us know what you're up to. Yeah, let us know what you're up to. Will that influence your plans for the weekend? Let us know outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or you can text us 80295 or give us a ring 08085 92 95 00. Now, to get your brain working,
we need to put in a rider here.
Go on.
You're going to need to listen very, very carefully and probably turn the volume up first.
Right, turn the volume to max and listen to this week's mystery sound. Tricky. Very tricky. It's a good one. It's a good one. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or ring us on 08085 92 95 00.
Gee, I thought it was aquatic for a start. Mm-hmm. You know, initially I'm thinking like herring or something like that, but I can hear geese in the background. So unless the geese are in real trouble, no.
Mm. I'm saying absolutely nothing because I know the answer.
Do you?
Yeah.
Swig. Mm-hmm. Plenty of birdsong in the air now. I mean, there was lots and lots. I was out in the fields yesterday and without a word of a lie, there must have been knocking on for a dozen skylarks that I could hear. Mm. It was just a wall of sound. It was beautiful.
Yeah, let us know what you've been hearing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be great. First, though, a charity in Moray which offers outdoor learning and adventure activities is about to celebrate a special birthday. For nearly 21 years, Outfit Moray, which you may have heard of, has been providing courses and experiences both on water and land for thousands of children, including those from disadvantaged backgrounds. Well, earlier this week, I spoke to some of those involved at a paddleboarding and kayaking session at the beautiful Portnochy Harbour.
The trick is that if you angle your blade, well, you can play with it, today in the water, it's going to have you go straight line. Okay. So you guys ready for an adventure today?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay, let's grab your board.
It's so cold!
I'm Tony Brown. I'm the CEO of Outfit Murray. So today we are doing a paddleboarding and kayaking session for one of the local primary schools who are as part of their activities week.
And is this kind of fairly typical of the things that you offer?
It is, yes. We offer a wide range of activities, both on land and on the sea and on the rivers. But the activities are usually tailored to what the group are trying to achieve. They might be working towards a proficiency award in a particular activity, or it might be introducing them to new activities that they haven't tried before and perhaps signposting them to the local clubs.
So tell me how the charity got going 21 years ago.
So the charity was started largely in response to disinvestment in outdoor learning that was happening during the 90s due to government cuts. And the founder of the charity, Ian Jameson, he worked in outdoor learning at the time and was concerned that young people were going to miss out on all of the opportunities and benefits that outdoor learning brings. So he decided with a group of like-minded friends to start the charity. And we've just been going from strength to strength for the last 21 years.
You don't want to go too much behind you, because look at what's happening to me. Yeah? Do I look stable?
No.
No.
It's not just outdoor skills, is it? It's not just learning how to go out in a paddleboard or a kayak. It's all the other stuff as well, the confidence and teamwork.
There's a lot of soft skills involved in the outdoors. Confidence, as you say, self-esteem, improvements when they achieve things in the outdoors. But one of the biggest benefits is building resilience. And you know, we know that there are a lot of young people who, as a result of the COVID pandemic, have been struggling with their own personal resilience to get out and do things. And this is such a good way of building resilience in young people, because they have to cope with the weather, the environmental factors when they're out and about, as well as they're learning new skills at the same time. And that is a challenge in itself, which when they succeed gives them a huge boost.
And are you always adding new activities to your portfolio?
Yes, we recently, in the last few years, added whitewater rafting into the portfolio, which has been fantastically well received. It's a great activity for team building, because if the team don't all work together, the raft doesn't go anywhere. So having the opportunity to do that on the River Spey and the River Findhorn as well, giving young people exposure to these fabulous waterways that run through Murray that they wouldn't otherwise get out on, and getting the perspective of looking at it from the river rather than from the banks. We talk to the young people about the natural world when they are out and about with us, and we can see things like changes in erosion patterns. When we're paddling over at Kingston, for instance, we can see the shifting shingle banks over time, and we can talk to them about that and the impacts that things like climate change are having on the natural environment. And if they then want to take that further, do more about it, try and make a positive difference, then that's really helpful.
What's it like running a charity like this when funding must always be at the back of your mind? And as we know, funds are tight.
It is a real challenge. We know that cost is the biggest barrier to participation for young people and families in terms of involvement in the outdoors, because a lot of these activities are not very cheap in terms of equipment and so on to put on. So we see it being critically important at this particular time to raise as much funds as we possibly can in order to create the opportunities in a way that are accessible for the majority of people to be able to take part in. And we've seen since the COVID pandemic an enormous increase in challenges that young people are facing, particularly around rising levels of anxiety, and some of that is manifesting in rising levels of non-attendance in formal education. And we can provide a significant input to try and help support those young people and get them back into education, get them back feeling more confident and able to engage in life in general, because otherwise there's going to be a whole generation of people missing out. And the costs of what we do are also rising. So you've got what's often referred to as a perfect storm of rising need and rising costs. both of which mean that there's enormous pressures on the finances of the charity to be able to try and keep up.
Yeah! I'm Carter Geddes. I'm a trainee at Outfit Murray. So I started volunteering spring last year and then volunteered all throughout summer and then went into a traineeship in September. And then I've been doing that since.
And did you come on trips like this when you were a youngster at school?
Yeah, mostly through high school. Did a few, yeah.
And what was that like for you?
It was good, yeah. Got out of school, so I was pretty happy for that.
Am I detecting there that you didn't love school?
Yeah. I just like being outdoors. Can't really sit still, me, so just like doing stuff, really.
My name is Karen Cox and I'm the community and corporate fundraiser as well as an administrator.
We're just watching some of the children kayaking and paddleboarding just now. How does it make you feel when you see that?
I'm incredibly proud of what Outfit Murray does and the difference they make to the lives of the young people on our activities. And you can see it even when they've been out for a day, if they've been out on several activities or done one of our long-term programmes. You know, the difference in them, they just stand taller, their shoulders are back, and you can just see that just gives them that little bit of extra confidence. And it's just really good to see.
Karen Cox, Carter Geddes and Tony Brown from Outfit Murray, and they've organised a trot along the Murray Coast Trail on the 20th of April to celebrate their big birthday. You can find more information on the charity's Facebook page and there's a link to that on our website.
What do you mean a trot?
A trot, just a walk.
Just a walk?
Yeah, they describe it as a trot. Doesn't involve horses.
A wee donner.
Yeah, a wee donner, yeah. And what a fab playground they've got. You know, the Murray Coast. Brilliant, you can do so much.
It is fantastic, all those wee harbours and things.
Nice.
I had a friend who had a boat in White Hills and for many, many years, and they were basically revamping White Hills, so all the boats, everything that had been there had to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. What a fantastic way that was to explore harbours that you'd never seen before and discover just how terribly tidal they were, some of them.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But, you know, I'd not been at Portnochy Harbour for a long time and I just thought, what a fab place for kids to go to because it's really quite sheltered,
yes.
Compact, but so picturesque.
Mm-hmm. Port's lovely.
Too. Yeah,
Port's
very nice.
Very pretty too. Very good chip, and I'll come to that. But never mind. Talking of birthdays, because obviously it was Outfit Murray's birthday, the Kelpies, just they are an incredible landmark since their installation at the entrance to the Forth and Clyde Canal at Grangemouth 10 years ago. To mark the 10th anniversary, there's going to be a big day of events Saturday, 27th of April, that's today, by the way, including demonstrations by Clydesdale horses, two of whom the Kelpies are modelled on. Now, earlier this week, around 30 Clydesdales gathered to launch the event, and our very own Laura Guthrie went along to speak to some of their owners.
I'm Shona Campbell, and I'm part of Rolling Thunder Clydesdales from the northeast of Scotland.
And who are we standing in front of at the moment?
This is a 12-year-old gelding, Rolling Thunder Mr. Bojangles, who is broken to ride and drive. And behind him is a black mare called Rolling Thunder Maggie May, who is broken to ride.
And tell me a little bit more about them. They look absolutely beautiful. I know nothing about Clydesdales, so give me a little some stats on these beautiful horses.
Bo would be in height about 18.3, Maggie about 18.2. They're both homebred. They weigh around 850-900 kilos as an adult. As I say, he's 12, Maggie's 10.
And historically, what would these horses have been used for?
These horses would be used on farms mostly and for pulling drays for breweries, but mostly in Scotland on farms, farm work. But obviously tractor mechanisation really did them in. Thus, they're on the Rare Breed Survival Trust at risk. The Clydesdale Horse Society registers about 180 to 200 foals a year, which is really, in the scheme of things, very small, so they are at risk and have to be cared for.
And the clue is in the name, of course. These are a Scottish horse. They originated here.
They originated in Clydeside in Lanarkshire. That's their name. Most at that time, after a mechanisation, most of them were exported. Lots went to the States and Canada, and they registered about 600 foals a year. So they're much bigger breeders than we are. But they are incredibly difficult to breed with. They're difficult to get mares in full, they're difficult to keep the foals, they're difficult to birth the foals.
And tell me what we're here for today. What's happening?
Well, this is obviously the 10th anniversary of the Kelpies, which were modelled on two, as you know, modelled on two Clydesdales from Glasgow Council, Barron and Duke. And because of that, they want a photo shoot with the Clydesdales, as many Clydesdales as possible, in front of the Kelpies as an anniversary photo shoot.
And why is this something that you wanted to come and take part in today?
Rolling Thunder, personally, we like to do things like this with the Clydesdales to raise awareness of them, to talk to the public. We take them to care homes, you know, we take them to galas, just anything the public want to see Clydesdales and get up close and personal with the Clydesdales, we'll do it. When you see them standing in the field, they don't look so big, but boy, you get up close to these guys and you realise you've got a load of horse in your hands.
And they look, they're very personal. We're getting a good looking at here. Hello. Hello. Sniff the microphone. Hello. Oh. They are incredibly large when you, like you say, when you're standing up close to them, yeah.
They're also very people-oriented. They absolutely love people, which I think would be in their genes from working so closely with one person. I think they really are people horses. They're just wonderful animals to be around. They're such a pleasure to have.
My name's Caitlin Hansen, and this is Lockcoat Thomas. His stable name is just Thomas, though. He's a big, gentle giant.
He's very interested in the microphone there for a wee moment. Tell me where you've come from today and why you wanted to take part in the event.
So I've come over from Lanark. I wanted to be part of the event because it'll be part of Scottish history, especially with the Clydesdale breeds being a rare breed in Scotland, kind of all over, really. I think it was a great thing to be part of.
So you're obviously from the heartland of where these horses originated as well.
Yeah, so Lanark is where the first Clydesdale came from, so it's fantastic to kind of show Clydesdales from there and show that's where we are based.
Oh, he's lovely, isn't he? And what do you normally do with him? Are you in the show circuit? Does he do any work?
So he doesn't drive. I am in the show circuit. We show in hand and ridden. He's 12 years old. I broke him myself when he was 3, and I've shown him ever since, in hand and ridden.
And tell me a little bit more about him. What is his personality like? I feel like he's quite cheeky.
He is very cheeky, but with his age, you wouldn't think it, because he doesn't act it. He still acts like a baby. He's only ever been owned by myself. I bought him from the breeder at 1 year old, and he's just a massive baby. Loves anything that he shouldn't have, food, drinks, tea, coffee. He's just a big sook. He's just a lovable big guy.
So I've moved round to right in front of the Kelpies now, and the procession of Clydesdales is coming along the canal bank right now in front of me. So back where they would originally have walked along the towpath, towing boats, and today they're just having a lovely walk round before they get in front of these very impressive sculptures for their photo call.
Andy Scott, I'm a sculptor.
And your amazing works of art are right behind us just now. And obviously they were based on two Clydesdale horses.
Yeah.
I saw you earlier with them. You looked like you were having an amazing time.
I was, I really was. It was fantastic. Luckily for me, they gave me a little foal called Millie. And I think it proved that I'm a better welder than I'm a horse handler, that's for sure. But she was very gentle with me. And she led the parade of the horses up to the Kelpies there, as you could see. And it really was a very special day. It's just been fantastic. Absolutely wonderful.
And how important is it to you to have that connection with models that you work to? How is that important to you?
It was vital. It was really, when we first hatched the idea all those years ago, must be nearly 20 years ago now, when I first dreamt them up, we were very lucky to contact Glasgow City Council. They had Clydesdale horses at that point, and they brought two of the horses, came to my studio in Maryhill in Glasgow, and they were my kind of muse, my models for the whole project, and really gave me the inspiration. And I'll be honest with you, I kind of fell in love with the Clydesdale breed. They're such a magnificent animals. Just the power, the elegance, and also the kind of their gentle nature, you know. They're just magnificent, and they've become a real passion for me in terms of sculpture making. And of course, to take them to this scale was really a very, very special, a blessing, I guess, you know.
And seeing them here when they were coming along the canal towpath, where they would have been, where they would have actually worked, I mean, that was actually something that was quite special to see, wasn't it?
It really was. I must admit, I was getting a bit glassy-eyed watching it all. It was just fantastic. When they pulled up in the car park and they started coming out of the trailers there, I was getting all emotional. It was just beautiful, it really was.
And they have such a cuthy nature, don't they? They're so sort of stoic almost. Do you think that's something that you kind of have captured in the sculptures here?
Well, it's nice of you to say that. Yeah, I guess I was kind of always going for some a kind of sense of a kind of calm dignity, if you like, you know, monumental, but also a feeling of kind of tranquility. And it's just been so lovely over the years to hear how people respond to the sculptures and how it evokes emotions and memories with them. I mean, almost on a weekly basis, we still get, you know, emails and such like, and all over social media. It's just wonderful, you know. As I say, I feel very blessed. A huge team effort, I have to say, you know. There was hundreds of people involved. I sometimes joke that I feel like the centre forward that scored the winning goal. But
and you touched on it there. It was obviously an idea that was hatched more than 10 years ago. They celebrate their 10th birthday in April. How does that make you feel? As you say, people still have such a connection to them.
Yeah, it makes me feel old. No, I don't know. It's an overused phrase, but I feel tremendously proud, you know. I remember I actually found a report I wrote nearly 20 years ago, and I said that they have the potential to become an icon for the country, and I'm very pleased to say that seems to have happened. Without meaning to sound big-headed, they really seem to have been taken to the hearts of the people of Scotland and the UK, even from down south. They were made in Yorkshire, you know, so it was a real national, broad, wide project, and yeah, I'm very, very proud. It's, as I say, it's a bit of a hackneyed phrase, but it's true, you know. It's amazing, absolutely amazing.
That was sculptor of the Kelpies, Andy Scott, there. And if you'd like to find out more about their 10th anniversary celebrations, there's a link on our website. It has been pointed out to me by our production team, much more astute than I this morning, that it is not actually the 27th of April. It is the 30th of March. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. She's not confused. I'm saying no about me. Coming up, I test the waters of the North Sea with the Baltic Boys of Aberdeen.
I'm constantly confused. Let's have a listen to the mystery sound. It's a good one. It's hard.
It is hard.
Very,
it is
very hard.
Yeah. And to be honest, I mean, if you're listening on medium wave, forget it.
Email us if you want to have a guess, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or you can text 80295 or give Sky a ring this morning on 0808 592 9500.
Now, the coolants in Sky are remarkable. You know, I don't know how many people over the years have probably thought, oh, I must go and do the cooling in Sky, and you get there and you're looking at it and go, wow, you know, I wasn't expecting that. One of the most effective ways of seeing it close up is by taking a boat trip to Loch Carusk. Now, 20 odd years ago, I made a programme about this range, and I did that very thing.
Donald McKinnon. My family have lived in Elgo for many generations before Prince Charlie's time. We live right down the kind of shorefront. I run pleasure boat trips from Elgol over into the Coolin Mountains. We've been running for around just over 10 years now. We were fishermen and started doing the trips in the summer and the fish in the winter, and probably been over in total to cruise there probably about 8,000 times, if not more, you know. The loch, it sits right in the heart of the Coolin, around 2 miles long and half a mile wide, a big glacial loch. And from the house, we can actually see into Loch Carusk. North of us is the Coolin. The Coolin sits about 4 miles away from the house. And we can see the whole ridge from almost end to end. And every morning when you wake up, you know, you look out the window and you see that beautiful mountain range there. And there's something, there's a certain feel of them. There's no doubt about it. I don't think Elgol would be the place it is without the Coolins in the background. And it's certainly a place on a lovely day that can put a lump in my throat. And that's after going in thousands and thousands of times. So quite annoys me sometimes when you have people in the boat with a newspaper and they sit down the back there and they read a newspaper and I feel like going down ripping in half, you know. And you got other folk will say, do you not get tired of the same trip back and forth? But I think the beauty of it is the place is that as the sun comes up and the sun goes round throughout the day, it changes. the light changes and it picks out, you pick out different corries as the light, as the day goes on, and it's not the same hour by hour. It changes all the time, you know. We mainly take passengers, but we have had some some strange ones in our time, I suppose. We had a film a few years ago there. It was, a bit of it was actually done over in the Coolums. It was a film called Captain Jack. Had Bob Hoskins and Anna Massey, a few stars in it. And in one of the scenes, they were simulating a rockfall, and they had painted a huge pile of polystyrene rocks up just to look like the gabbro over there. And we took it all in the boat and actually filled the deck from end to end and about 3 metres high. And it was quite funny, really, because it looked so real. And certainly if that had been real rocket, the boat would have been sunk long ago, you know. But we always meant to get a photo so we could send it to the manufacturers of the boat and say to them, she's a grand cargo holder, this one, you know. We normally run actually over into the Coolums mainly during the summertime. But I was over just south of Elgle, and then in the wee tender just steamed into the Coolums, not far from where we actually normally land the boat. And it was early morning, the sun was just coming up, and it was just beautiful. The top section of the ridge was just starting to come, it was getting a bit of sun, and it's just pinky red on top and all in shade below. And it's beautiful, actually, as the sun rises, the kind of gap fills in, the light just slides down the ridge, you know. And it's so peaceful over there at this time of the year, especially. When I went in there, there was a few deer just above us, actually. Had a wee otter the other day as well, just playing around the boat. But it's for me, I suppose, as someone who goes, I'm always going over there with other passengers. For me, it was extra kind of special in a way to have a day like that and have the time myself to actually sit and enjoy it as well. I'm sure I was probably the only other soul on the Coolum that day. Unfortunately, I don't get a chance to go in there as often as I was like. You know, obviously, in the winter time is the only time I really get to go into the Coolum itself, and the days are much shorter and the weather's not always the best in the winter. Most often if I do take a hike in, I'll just go along the coastal path in the house here and up on Scoonastree is my favourite. Scoonastree's beautiful view, it's about 1500 feet high and you can see straight down the loch to the far end. There's many a day when folk are on the boat and they're heading off early morning, we're dropping them in to go up on the ridge for the day, and by gosh, I wished I'd be going with them, you know. Unfortunately, I'm very lucky, I suppose. I work in and out there all the time, so most of these people probably give the right hand to do what we're doing. So. It's a place where you have poor weather. It's I can honestly say at times it's the most miserable place I've probably maybe been to. But then straight away you get a nice day and up it comes and it shows itself and there it is and it's just so beautiful. And it's, I can't quite put my finger on actually what it is that kind of lures you towards the Coolum.
Donald McKinnon, the then captain of the Bella Jane in Lough Garusk. And if you'd like to hear more about what the Coolum Range means to those who live and work there, look up the Scotland Outdoors podcast on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, a really nice listen. I think I'm right in saying that he was quite an innovative character and that he was one of the first people to do commentary on the boat. Ah. And it'd be lovely to listen to his commentary.
Fabulous. He's got a great voice.
Yeah.
Absolutely great voice.
Lots of people getting in touch to say about the kind of birds that they've been seeing. Mm-hmm. So we were talking earlier about how migration might be getting a wee bit earlier. We're not very sure. But Gus Bowman in Burnt Island has been in touch. Good morning, he says. Currently sitting in the warmth of the Mediterranean on the Andalusia coast outside our motorhome. 2 years ago this week, I only remember this as I keep a motorhome diary, the out-of-doors programme was discussing the lack of swallows that had returned to Scotland by the end of March. Mm-hmm. At that time in 2022, we were surrounded with thousands of swallows and I messaged you during the programme. This year in the same area, we've not seen one swallow in the 4 weeks we've been here. Have the swallows arrived in Scotland yet with their duvet jackets and thermals on? Keep the great programmes coming, even better when you can listen to out-of-doors in the warmth. I'm sure it is.
We can answer that question. Because Colm mm-hmm. Scriven from Paisley has been in touch, saying, great to hear your sunny voices. It's been a while since I last wrote into the show. In fact, Ewan was still presenting in those days. Out of Doors is still the best programme on radio. He says, I go outdoor swimming every Saturday morning at Stanley Reservoir with the Paisley Wild Swimming Buddies. They are supportive, but mad group of people. True. I was swimming at Stanley last Saturday when I saw my first flock of swallows flying low over the reservoir when I was in the water. It was an incredible encounter with nature. I'm hoping that now we've passed the spring solstice, the water will be a wee bit warmer this morning. Thanks for all you do to support the outdoors in Scotland. All the best, Colm Scriven.
Ah, right.
So there have been swallows.
So they are appearing, yeah. I've certainly not seen that yet.
No, neither have I. And it's something, to be honest, I normally hear them before I see them.
Yeah.
You know, you hear that very distinctive cry that they've got. Nicola Edwards says, I'm listening cosy in bed. Shame on you, Nicola. Shame on you. You should be in cold water somewhere. The highlight of my bird week in Aberdeen was the large flock of siskins in the woods behind our house. We investigated due to the large volume of chatter that entered the house. It's the second time this year, apparently.
Very nice. Keep your comments coming.
Mm-hmm. Not too straight. Particularly, you know, anything that you think is... Because I said last week I thought that the geese had actually gone, but I'm not convinced they have.
No.
I'm still hearing them, but I think... Don't know.
No, not quite so often. Maybe.
No, well, I came out of the house this morning and I was hearing geese. I couldn't see them for whatever reason, but I could hear them. Very annoying. Coming up, I go for a very, very, very brief duke in the North Sea. It couldn't have been any briefer if I tried, to be honest. And I did. And we look at the Victorian art of seaweed pressing.
We also have a mystery sound for you this morning. Let's have a wee listen.
Do you want to give a clue? You're going to have to give a clue because I don't know what it is.
Okay, it's almost got an Easter-type theme.
Really?
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, Alistair from Greenock...
Is it a bunny with a cattle prod?
Alistair from Greenock thinks it's a Bowling Green water sprinkler.
Well, that's quite good. Lorna thought it might be the last of the horrendous hailstones that fell in Uddingston yesterday afternoon.
David John Chadwick in Carluke says, we're travelling south on the A9 later this morning and we're hoping for a clear road with no delays. Good luck in the Easter weekend. I think the mystery sound is leaves rustling in the wind.
Denise, Phil and Reggie the Labrador say, blue skies here too. It's looking like a promising day. We have family up from Bowness and we'll be heading to Lossiemouth Beach to let the dog Maple run free. It's today's mystery sound, the static sounding scratches on Denise's copy of The Specials, Much Too Young, 7-inch record. Fantastic programme, pure radio sunshine.
And Craig in Bearstown says it's a baby cygnet sleeping, surely. All good guesses,
It's a ticking noise, though. And then, seriously, if you were listening to this with the volume turned down, we will be doing this later in the programme, so turn the volume right up, we'll warn you the next time. Because there is a clicking noise on it.
Mm-hmm. There is.
But what generates that? I have genuinely no idea.
It's a mystery, and that's why it's a mystery sound. Get in touch outofdoors at bbc.co.uk, text us 80295 or give us a ring 0808 592 9500.
Over the last few years, open water swimming has become increasingly popular. Although, one thing that I have noticed about this is that, to my mind, the vast majority of people who go out open water swimming are of the female persuasion, and I don't entirely understand that. Recently, I joined a group whose main aim is not just to swim, but rather what they call cold water dipping, and they are male. The group meet on Aberdeen Beach, and Matt Midler is the founder.
We are the Baltic Boys Aberdeen, and we're a cold water immersion group for men.
That's unusual. The vast majority of people I see in the water tend to be women's groups.
Yeah, I don't quite know why that is, but it's the reason why we've set up a men's group, to try and encourage more men to enjoy the benefits of cold water immersion. We've got about 65 guys in the Baltic Boys Aberdeen now, and I would say for a lot of us, one of the main reasons we come is because of the benefits to our mental health. So whether that's low mood, depression, anxiety, for me, I think a bit of all of those things throughout my life, the main benefit for me is it feels like it recharges my batteries. So when I come out of the water for the rest of the day, I've got motivation, energy that I might not have had before.
Do you miss it if you don't do it?
Yes. Yeah, I've had depression for 15, 20 years, still on medication, but if you don't get that reset, and when you're in the water, you can't think about anything else. You are just in the moment.
How often in a week do you do this?
Guaranteed every Sunday. Some of us go on a Saturday and there might be the odd person who comes during the week, or as a wee group we've got on social media, so we can say, oh, is anyone free for a dip? And it just depends when everyone suits, but guaranteed on a Sunday at 10 a.m.
What's the form here? I mean, basically, do you walk in slowly? Do you rush in screaming? What do you do?
There's some do both or either. Yeah, I tend to walk in and then go out my depth, swim about for a bit and come back out, give it 5-6 minutes. Some people go in as deep as ankles or as over your head. It's what suits you. Okay. There's no judgment. The group do what we want to do. So if you feel you've had enough, get out. There's, you know, don't be scared if you're too cold.
There was a bit of a gag earlier about what's your emergency contact number. Ha, ha, ha. Is that, I mean, seriously, do you have to think in terms of, you know...
Yeah, we actually once more and more people started turning up, we arranged a safety session that the Aberdeen Surf Life Saving Club gave us for free about cold water immersion and how to read the tides and things, and that was really beneficial for us, just so we could look out for each other.
Yeah, I have to say, it's not the nicest of days. The day is grey and it was raining earlier, but, you know, at least it's dry at the moment and it's very, very calm out there.
Yeah, the great irony is that although we spend a lot of time getting into the cold water, there's nothing worse than being rained on when you come out, getting changed
you know,
in the rain.
Divers say that?
Yeah, getting changed in the rain or trying to dry yourself when you're getting rained on is a bit of a nightmare.
He says there's nothing worse than rain. It's the snow would probably be worse than rain. I think it's the sea's quite a constant temperature, whereas once you're out, the wind chill sets in. And that's...
Really windy, really rainy. It's probably one of the worst.
It was -3 in January. It was -3 out, but the water was about 4, and the snow showers were coming over from Buchan, and you're thinking, yeah, I really shouldn't be standing here, just in my togs. But you get dressed quickly.
You turned up late and I didn't get your name, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's Alex.
Alex, right. Yeah. How long have you been doing this?
Since November, like the 5th of November, that's when my first dip was.
Why?
I was a third
year... That's going to be the question for all of you, really.
Third year anthropology student doing a project with the Baltic Boys for a submission.
You are studying them?
I'm studying with them, yeah.
Diplomatically put. Mm-hmm. And are you trying to work out why people are doing this now? Or?
It was, like, at first to work out why people are doing it and to understand the experience of it. But for, like, my next project, it's looking at how people use the beach and how the use and, like, the infrastructure of the beach is going to change because of that.
I am kind of taken aback. I know this beach well. I used to come here on holiday when I was a boy because my great-aunt actually had a place up there in the square. The amount of sand that's been shifted off this is unreal.
Oh, it's constantly changing, and that's something that to be wary of as well. You know, we've been doing this over a year now, and the conditions, the rips, you've got to watch out for, because as the ground changes underneath, you can't see that from outside of the water, and that can obviously affect... I mean, you can see here, there's the distribution of rock and sand and how it shifts.
I mean, basically, in any other conditions, you would need a bulldozer to shift that amount of material.
Exactly,
but, you know, the water does it no bother at all.
It is. It's impressive. The power of nature.
Yeah.
All part of the fun, really. You get in and learn about yourself and what you can take and the exposure and how you feel and the mindfulness that comes with that, but also learning about the sea and the nature and just being out here and enjoying it.
When I turned up for a start and looked over the sea wall, you were litter picking.
Yeah, I had a spare half hour just before you guys arrived, and there's a lot of litter about, so you just pick up a bit as you're going. Matt put out on the Instagram a month ago, like, if you have any minutes just beforehand or after, we'll just do that. Have to do your bit.
I am racking my brains to think of any other questions that will put off going into the water for a minute longer, and I just can't. So
safety, you just have to be safe when you're in there. You have to be aware of what you're doing. Don't do it on your own. You know, join a group, see, you know, and there are different groups out there. So one group might not suit you, so don't just stop the first time you do it. Go and find a group that get you or that you get, and just enjoy it. But you have to be safe. At the you know, first and foremost is safety, and we look out for each other when we're in the water and outside the water. That's just part of the Baltics. It's just support.
As Dave says, you know, it's about community for us. So it's, for me, it's half cold water, half the relationships that we have in the group. So our motto is cold at sea, warm at heart, and I think that really sums up, you know, what we're all about. We're getting in the cold water, we're doing something a bit mad, but also, you know, we're all great friends.
Right, where are we going to go in? The voices there of Matt, Ruben, Mitchell, Andy and Alex, some of the Aberdeen Baltic boys, and we will return a little later on. For the moment, when I actually went into the North Sea.
Yeah, after all your procrastination.
Stalled as long as I could.
We were just talking there about why it seems to attract more women than men. Mm-hmm. And producer
Explain your... You agreed with it.
Producer Helen
might have said it, but you agreed with it.
It's because we handle pain better.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we don't
moan
about it.
Yes.
That's it.
Well, I think you'll be quietly impressed when you hear the next piece. Because, there's no fuss. There's no screaming or yelling or anything. We just go in there, as men do. Quietly go in there, take the pain, absorb it. You wouldn't even know we were suffering any discomfort at all.
Oh, you're right. You had your clothes back on within about 30 seconds.
Excuse me, the last time you went, where was it you went?
Cellardike.
Did you get your clothes off at all?
No. But I did have my gloves off. It was blooming cold.
I had my gloves off. Well, I'm impressed. Don't think I'm not.
It was January. I'm not daft. No, it was a popular pastime with the Victorians, but seaweed pressing has kind of fallen out of favour in more recent years. An artist in Crivi in the northeast coast is passionate about reviving the tradition. She's actually trying to create a wee community of seaweed pressers. She creates various pieces using a press that was actually designed by her husband. I met up with Portia Knight and we went in search of some seaweed.
So it's very seasonal, and I'm looking for different things at different times of the year. So in spring and summer, that's when it's very colourful, so I'll be collecting with an eye for colour. There are lots of lovely bright red and orange and pink seaweeds. And then winter months, it's quite different. I'm sort of not distracted by colour, and instead looking for shapes and textures. Spring's the really busy time, you know, when that first bit of fresh growth arrives. It's very exciting, and there's a sort of excitement at the bounty and a little bit of a slightly panicky feeling that, you know, you might not get it all in time and before it all goes, you know, before it all disappears again.
We found some.
Well, something like this, you know, a kelp stipe with that amazing dulse sprouting off it, hanging down.
A really beautiful colour.
Yeah.
It's a dark brown, almost red in places.
Yes, yeah, and translucent, isn't it? So when you hold it up and you can see the light through it, you really get the colours and the layers.
And you get the smell as well.
And
don't
you get the smell. Do you get the smell? I think I've become immune, actually. I'm not sure I can smell it quite as strongly as anybody else. The family aren't so keen.
Oh, now that looks quite different. What's that?
Yeah, so this is a piece of egrec, tiny little bit, and this is the air bladder. And that's what helps the seaweed to float to the top so that it can photosynthesise. I learnt recently that these air bladders grow different sizes depending on whether they're somewhere growing somewhere sheltered or not. So the bigger the air bladder, the more sheltered the site that it grew on. And sometimes you can see this egret growing on a sheltered side of a rock and it has quite large bladders, and then on the other side of the rock the bladders would be considerably smaller. This is a funny one.
Yeah, what's that? Looks a bit like sort of straw.
Yeah, so this, I love the common names of some seaweeds. This one's called Landlady's Wig. And it's got a really funny texture. It's a very matted, long, thin, sort of hair-like strands, a bit like horse's hair, really. Horse's mane, maybe.
Let me just feel it a second.
Ah. And the way it, it's very difficult to tease apart. It has little, I don't know, they're not quite hooks, but little spikes all the way along it, which you can't actually see, which means that it doesn't move smoothly against itself. It, it catches.
Yeah, so it looks quite delicate, but it's actually quite tough.
It is tough. What I like to do with some of this winter seaweed that washes up the wrecks and the kelps and the, is to sometimes I make a wreath Christmas time instead of a, you know, one with ivy and things. I use seaweed, and this makes a really great base.
there are something like 650 different types of seaweed in the UK. You must have got pretty good at identifying a lot of them.
Yeah, I found it really, really overwhelming in the beginning. I'm not a marine biologist, you know. I'm an artist. And I was that person that used to step over that slimy layer at the beach to get to what I thought was the good stuff, you know, the stripy pebble, the sea glass, the whatever, anything but the seaweed, the water. So, you know, when I first started picking them up, I remember saying to my husband, I'm never going to know what these are. You know, I had got myself an ID book and it just was all just seemed like nonsense to me. I couldn't make sense of any of it. But slowly, slowly, just by coming out here repetitively and seeing things over and over again and seeing them at different stages of the life, you know, I've gained some knowledge. And also, other people are very generous. You know, I started posting what I was finding on Instagram and saying, please, you know, if you know what it is, let me know. And people were very generous with their knowledge and would kind of send me messages saying, I think that's this or that or the other. We had an event in the village August last year, and I thought it'd be nice to set out and see how many different seaweeds I could find to display for the locals and for my neighbours. And I, of course, I was worried that I might not find anything at all, but it was a lucky day. I came out and, you know, just from the drift, so not harvesting, I found something like 32 different species just in one kind of hour that I was able to put out and trays and things and show everybody.
So there is a lot to be found.
There's a lot to be found. There's a lot to be found. You just have to slow down and look.
I'm intrigued about what changed for you. What made you decide that the seaweed was no longer that slimy stuff that you wanted to skip over and actually be something that is at the heart of your creative designs?
Yeah. What changed? I was looking for a creative activity to do while I was here, and I wanted it to be specific to this place, so it needed to be something to do with the sea. That made sense. I knew of seaweed pressing. I was aware that it had been quite popular with Victorians, and I knew that there were a couple of other people doing it, and my husband was going to be able to make me a press. So I thought, well, there's a lot of seaweed there, why don't I give it a go? You know, this looks like something that I could probably manage. I was absolutely blown away by not so much what I've found, because it can look quite different when it's wet and when it's dried. So it can look kind of unpromising here on the shore. But once you get it back and you clean it up and you spread it out and you press it onto white paper, it can be really quite astonishing. Just the amazing colour and form and just beauty. So I think it was just that surprise. And sometimes when you come to something, I think, with a sort of outsider's perspective. So I wasn't living by the sea. I didn't grow up living by the sea. Sometimes you come perhaps with a slightly more open mind. But it was that revelation when I opened the press that first time. I thought, goodness me, this is incredible.
And we'll be back with Portia a little later in the programme to find out how she sorts and presses the seaweed. I should say she only uses drift seaweed, so she doesn't harvest anything at all. Because she thinks it's everywhere. You know, you can get the drift anywhere. And also, the sun bleaches it, so it creates interesting colours.
Last time I saw it, there was an exhibition, I think, at the Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. And it was stuff, and it was that was up against, I'm sure it was between sheets of glass. And the forms are really beautiful.
Yeah, really, really beautiful and really quite different as well.
Yeah,
great. Lots of people getting in touch. Gav and Autumn say, Gavin and daughter Autumn, listening from bed in a youth hostel in Amsterdam. We're on our way back to Edinburgh from a week at the Efteling theme park. Got the start of the show for once because we're an hour ahead here. Going to head to Amsterdam Zoo later today. Love the show.
Forrest Lill's been in touch saying, beautiful day here, listening outside for the first time this year. No fire for me, just a wee dog hot water bottle. Absolutely no idea in the mystery sound, even with full volume. Today, I'm going to get some new chooks to add to the flock, so I'll be making sure they don't kill each other.
Alan Mark says, we've also had siskins at the bird feeder this week. Greenfinches, chaffinches and bullfinches enjoying the sunflower hearts. Nuthatches back to geese overhead as well.
I said, well, I heard them this morning, but I couldn't see them. Very annoying. A sure sign of the changing seasons is when ospreys start coming back to Scotland after their winter sojourn in the southern hemisphere. Louis the Osprey has returned to Loch Arkaig in the Highlands on Thursday, which is, to be honest, earlier than his usual arrival date. In previous years, he's returned anywhere between the 2nd and the 11th of April.
So why could it be then that these ospreys and other birds are returning early this year, even though spring seems late to us? Well, we're delighted to be joined by Roy Dennis of the Roy Dennis Foundation, who spent a lifetime working on ospreys. Good morning, Roy. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
Is Louis an early arrival in Scotland, or do you know of others?
The first one was at Loch of the Lows on the 8th of March, which is very early. And even here in Murray, I saw my first one on the 19th of March. And that was the earliest I'd ever know in my part of the world. But yesterday, I checked 5 nets, and there was only 1 adult bird. So 1 out of 10 were early, and the rest are probably, you know, about on time, although they're definitely earlier nowadays. You know, it's 1960, I saw my first osprey at Loch Garten, and that was on the 8th of April. And over the years, they have got earlier.
Any idea why, Roy?
Well, there's a couple reasons. More of them are wintering in Spain and Portugal and North Africa, and even as far north as southern Brittany. So those birds would see, you know, the signs of spring coming. But remember, most of them are in West Africa, where there's very little change. Kind of, you know, if they're living in Senegal, they don't know that we've got a really early spring here. So I think it's a general trend that things are returning earlier. But there's another reason, and that's that there are more. So nowadays, there's more competition for the good nest. So it's wise to get back early in case someone else steals your nest.
And what are they doing just now, those ones that have returned?
Well, I looked at the bird yesterday that I first saw, a week or more ago, and the nest had been really battered by the winter storms. And, there was just some sticks in the top of the tree. Well, it's actually a female that's back, but she's near enough half-built a new nest.
And you pioneered satellite tracking on ospreys. Talk us through this, if there is such a thing, a sort of typical journey. You know, if where are they coming from? You know, do they come in a straight line? Do they go out to sea? What do they do?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, we've had ospreys wintering in West Africa. We know them well. They've been bred here. I remember one was 25 years old when she last laid eggs. And there they are in a place in West Africa where they're in the same tree each winter. And they may only fly, you know, a couple hundred meters into the sea and catch a fish. So they're extraordinarily sedentary. And then suddenly one morning, they set off and head up over the Sahara Desert. And right over the Sahara, across the Straits of Gibraltar usually, up through Spain, generally trying to hit the west end of the Pyrenees, then to the Cherbourg area, across to Dorset, up through to Bristol, straight up the kind of marches between Wales and England, get up to Cheshire, turn a wee bit to the right, up over the borders, and home.
Just on that route that you've been talking about there, are there risks along that route? You know, are there threats to them?
Yeah. These ospreys are always taking a chance. You know, are you going to be early? Make certain you're back to your nest first. Or could you run into difficulty? And we had a favourite old bird called Beatrice. And she only wintered just north of Gibraltar on the eastern side of Spain. And then she used to fly up to a flooded river just north of the Pyrenees, have about 10 days there and then fly home. And one winter, one early spring, she came back early and arrived in the Pyrenees in the most appalling wet weather. And We even got a friend of ours in that area to check her out. And in the end, she couldn't find any fish at all because everywhere was flooded. The rivers were flooded. And in the end, she died on a riverside and this friend of mine picked her up. So she made a mistake. She should have stayed in the south and she would have been okay.
Yeah, it's a sad story, isn't it? Do you still find that you get excited when you see them returning?
I you know, this is going to be my 84th birthday in a month's time. And I just love seeing all these things come back. Interestingly, I like to know of them as individuals. So I think, you know, will that old bird return again for his 19th year or won't he? So, yeah, but then I take that joy. You know, this morning I'm looking out of my window. It's sunny as can be. It's a beautiful day. And suddenly there's a red squirrel there running up and down the birch trees just outside my window. So I find nature just wonderful for you as an individual.
I don't suppose there's anybody in Scotland who's got a better knowledge of these birds than you. If, you know, you say your local female is back, does that mean you have any sense at all of when the male might arrive?
No.
An honest answer, a daft question, Roy, thank you.
No, because, you know, you see these two birds and they're going to spend the whole summer together and then they set off. But the female leaves Scotland 3 weeks ahead of her young and her mate. And then the male is the last one to go. But it could be that the female is wintering in Morocco and the male is in Guinea-Bissau. They're not together in the winter and they could be very far apart. But interestingly, my colleague in my foundation, Tim McCrill, who lives beside Rutland Water, they had their first back on the 12th at a favourite nest. But the female arrived on the 13th, so they were very close together. And interestingly, he thinks they get back too early, because if they don't, the Egyptian geese lay eggs in their nest and keep them off it.
Fascinating. Roy, thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
And you. Bye-bye.
Take care. See you later. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Sitting right next to me here at Beech Grove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this...
Yep, there are a few ways of listening. Absolutely, we tell you this every week. You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. We love hearing from you. Let us know where you listen, which is what Terry O'Neill's done here. He says, I stay in Qatar in the city of Doha. Usually listen on my one-hour journey to my office working at a local industrial gas plant in the north of the country. I've been listening to the podcast for about 2 or 3 years. It used to be on solo hikes up the Munros in Scotland with my Westie, but now I listen travelling on the 5-lane motorway through the desolate, sanitised scrubland of the desert.
The highest point in the peninsula, and I'm going to murder this, I'm sorry, is Crann Uba Al Bol at 103 metres near the south border, which is dwarfed by the buildings with a few over 300 metres. Temperatures are quite moderate just now, about 25 degrees, but next month it starts ramping up, oh wait for it, to reach more than 50 degrees in the summer.
I couldn't
can you
do
imagine that?
That?
No, neither no,
I couldn't,
can I.
I could not cope with that.
No, Terry says, love the show's content, the presenters and features, and always look forward to every new episode. That's from Terry O'Neill in Doha in Qatar. Time now though for our mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
Turn the volume up.
The easiest.
It's not.
Nope.
Although we do have two correct answers already, apparently.
Apparently, yeah.
Gavin and Cooper says, I think the mystery sound could be Mark's little turnstones. All the best.
Millie in Edinburgh sounds like an old gramophone sticking. Aye, it does.
Richard and Mandy say, we are in Devon, and today, here, it's the 30th of March, 2024. Yes, yes, I know. We didn't realise we were a month behind Scotland, where apparently it's the 20th. Listen, I said we'll get it. Seriously thought it meant we'd be able to get the days of events next month, so we'll not be far away then. P.S. Is the mystery sound a stuck record?
Mm-hmm. Janet from Perth. Morning, lovely outsiders. I was delighted to see a flock of curlews in a field outside Scone earlier this week. They must have been resting on their way elsewhere as they've disappeared now. Is today's mystery noise Rachel's hard-boiled eggs boiling in the pan before getting ready to be painted for Easter.
I heard curlews down in Irvine Beach. Eric from Roslyn says, is the mystery sound prawns treading water at a sewage outlet? No, but it's a nice idea.
Mm-hmm. And Craig Wilson from Cardonald has a clever suggestion. Is today's sound the air being pressed and released from the seaweed in your piece on seaweed pressing?
Alistair in Elgin is posing a nice one here. He says, good morning, Rachel and Mark. A beautiful, sunny, crisp morning in Elgin. A very difficult mystery sound today. My guess is it's static picked up when Mark tries to retune his wireless. But he also wants some advice. He wants to know, how do you dissuade a badger from using your garden as a toilet? A couple of months ago, it started under the southwest beach hedge, and now the north orchard looks like I've had a bad day with a nine iron. Any legal suggestions welcome. I haven't the faintest idea.
No, but I bet one of the listeners will know.
I bet
get in touch, tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. Just crack on there.
Yeah, if you think you know the answer to that question, or even if you want to have a guess regarding the mystery sound, then get in touch. Email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, or you can give us a ring 08085 92 9500.
As you may recall, Christina Riley is the founder of something called the Nature Library. Now, the library gives folk the chance to peruse all forms of nature writing. I thought this was a really interesting concept. Now, it started off as a travelling library without premises, but now it's found a permanent home.
It's a travelling library of nature writing, whatever that means. It's quite broad. Basically, any books that have some sort of connection to the landscape, or whether that's specifically like climate change, or just it can be a fiction book that just really takes you in to the land, just really builds a world for you. So I was just reading these books and I love them. It was making me think about the environment in new ways and kind of getting across certain messages in the more environmental and climate focused subjects and issues that I wasn't really understanding before, or I understood and I cared about, but I didn't really grasp the full picture of it. And seeing like when books were written as well, I mean, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was written, was it like the 50s, 60s, and we're still dealing with a lot of these same issues. So that was something that kind of triggered something in me, and I just thought, oh.
So why did you think it was a good idea getting a fixed location, a home for it?
Well, it's both now. so I'm going to keep travelling because I love taking it to new places. I really want to just bring it to as many different communities as possible. But I've always kind of thought it would be nice to have a permanent space sometime in the future to have the full collection. There's quite a lot of books, so I can't take them to all the smaller places.
I just turned up in one of the streets here. Oh, right. Scottish Maritime Museum, Irvine. There's a plaque on the wall. The Shipyard Workers' Flat.
Yes. So these are with the Scottish Maritime Museum, which this has opened really in association with, because they're very kindly letting me into these flats to open the library.
This is a fantastic place.
It is. As soon as I walked in, I just thought, this is a library.
This is the right place.
Yeah,
absolutely the right place. Yeah. And it's interesting because it's, you know, it's pitch pine floorboards, but they've been actually painted dark brown at some stage, which you would expect to be oppressive, but where there's been a lot of activity, it's worn right through to the pine.
I love this. Like, I don't want to like sand them down or anything. I love this.
How big a collection have you got nowadays?
So there's around over 400 books, I know. It started with 70, and that was just my books, just my own personal collection. So I put them in Civic House in Glasgow. It filled about two or three shelves, and I just thought, I'll see if people come. And then now I've just been kind of buying them slowly but surely over time.
Do people donate them at all?
They do, yeah. Visitors will donate some of their own books. Writers and publishers as well will sometimes get in touch and say, like, would you want one of these for the library? And it's always yes, really. I've been introduced to so many new writers through that, so yeah.
You mentioned Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which is well worth a read, still well worth a read. What else? Give me another couple of suggestions of things that you think everybody should read.
That everybody should read, oh. The first thing, Mary Oliver, if you like poetry, or even if you don't think you like poetry, Mary Oliver is the one to just kind of, it's so accessible and she can do so much with so little, I think. So I would say pick up a few Mary Oliver poems and just see what you think. I did recently read, I'll say, a book called Palestinian Walks, which was fascinating because it's by Raja Shehadeh, and
he talks about walking through Palestine as a child and as an adult. And that Light Silent Spring for me was one where I thought, I've learned more from this book because it's been told as a story, and it's because it's been told by a single person, and yeah, them telling their story, than I would have learned from, you know, drier sources, you should say. So I find that really fascinating for different books. What else? I'll say, actually, there's a writer called Susanna V. Evans. I think maybe just standing here in the shipyard worker's flat, she has a poetry collection called Bright Work, which is all about, she did a residency in a shipyard. But that's the thing, I think it's quite difficult to say because it can be so personal. And the thing with nature writing is that it's so broad. You know, you don't need to be necessarily an outdoorsy person or like really into the environment or environmental causes. It can be anything. So,
My name is Eva Bukowska, and I work at the Scottish Maritime Museum as an exhibition and events officer.
How did you get involved with this project?
Well, Christina and I, we met at the University West of Scotland in Ayr. Christina told us her story and her background, and that she loves books and she owns the project called Nature Library. And actually, she contacted us previously because she was wondering if we could set up a small exhibition, a wee pop-up exhibition at the museum. And, you know, it was like a snowball effect. I thought, well, actually, we've got a great property that's actually unused at the moment. And she was looking for a hub, for a home for her library for a longer period of time. And that's how it happened. That's where we got involved. And I'm actually excited and very happy that we are part of it.
What I find really pleasing about this is it's, to a certain extent, it's an echo back to the past. That when shipbuilding started here, you know, the start of industrialization, etc., people very quickly became aware of the fact that people wanted to learn. So they would set up libraries, and sometimes they were posh libraries, like the Carnegie Libraries, you know, that actually had a library written over the door. But sometimes they were just buildings that had been donated by workplaces, etc., and they would stuff them full of books, and people would become experts in all sorts of arcane things, purely and simply because they had access to it. Mm-hmm. And by bringing it back to the sort of ship worker's cottage, it just closes the circle again.
That's truth. Mm-hmm. And it's quite exciting that we are the part of it, and as the Scottish Maritime Museum, we own the property, and it's just amazing that the history came to the circle. So we can have the nature library now here. Soon it will be open for the public and for everyone who would like to come and relax, enjoy the book.
Eva Bukowska there from Irvine Maritime Museum, and we also heard from Christina Riley of the Nature Library, which you can now find at Irvine Harbour.
Aye, interesting sounding place.
Yeah.
Really.
See, that building itself, it had an architectural feature on the inside of it, which I'd only previously seen in tenement flats in Glasgow. You know, sometimes in the big sort of tenement flats, they have quite a shallow cupboard. Mm-hmm. It tends to be in the corner of the room, somewhere along those lines, and you think, well, what was the point of that? What they were originally were passageways. So that, you know, that allowed the workmen to go from one side to the, you know, the tenement, you know, and work their way more or less right the way down the street. And only at the end were those things closed off and turned into shallow presses, you know, shallow cupboards either way. And they've got those in the ground floor in those fishermen's cottages.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
They store some books in there.
They will do eventually.
Yeah, I bet they will.
There were no books when I was in there, but, you know, you can see the potential. It's going to be good.
Yeah, really nice. John's been in touch because he's been listening to your piece on cold dipping.
Aye.
He says, during the 80s and 90s in the north of the town at the quayside, we saw two or three elephants in the sea. They were cold dipping in the Aberdeen water as they'd come from the Romanian circus and were quite enjoying it.
I don't know what you're implying there, John. I'm not sure I take kindly to it. Catherine Thompson in Falkirk says, we've had a lot of siskins in the garden this year. Still here, sometimes as many as 20. The British Trust for Ornithology says it's due to the wet weather, as the pine cones they usually feed on don't open. That's a good thought. Best wishes.
Donnie says, just wanted to say I'm out walking the two dogs this morning and saw a skein of geese at the beautiful blue sky, in the beautiful blue sky. So there are quite a few around Keith.
And Dave Kidd from Aberdeen says, enjoyed the Crivy Seaweed segment. Another one coming up. Earlier this month, I walked around the coast from the Viewpoint car park to Troophead and down to Crivy. It was sad that the village was deserted, bar a handful of folk working in properties, most of them not their own. Not sure what the answer is, but it's a huge problem for many tourist towns and villages.
Yeah, interesting point. When I was in Crivy, actually, it was quite busy. It was a gorgeous day like this, actually. Let's go back there now and hear again from Portia Knight, who uses seaweed to create artwork from her home in lovely Crivy. Once Portia has gathered up what she needs from the shore, she heads into her kitchen to repair it and then press it to make pictures and prints.
So I wash most of the seaweed in just tap water. There are a few species that don't like being in tap water, so some of the kelps will blister. Some of the very fine ferny seaweeds will bleed some colour, so some of the red will come out. Those ones need rinsing in filtered seawater. They usually have a bit of kind of debris in there, some bit of sand. At this point I might decide, you know, that actually that was a bit of a mistake, it's not something that I want. And I can literally go out the front door and throw it back, so it's not really a problem. Now, something like this, which is a piece of fine dulse, I will float in a tray of water, and you can see that it behaves quite differently when it's in and out of the water. So I use the water to again really see what it is that I've got there and to spread it out.
Look at the colour as well. It looks quite pink now, doesn't it? Yeah. And it didn't look like that
saw it earlier. No, it looked quite sort of brown, didn't it? So I've got that floated in a tray of water. I'm just going to reach over here. If I take a piece of watercolour paper, if I was just to take that dulse out and put it on the paper, then I've got quite a job to get the seaweed spread out. So instead what I do is float it in the tray of water, put the watercolour paper under the seaweed, and then lift both the water and the seaweed out together at the same time, and you'll see that the seaweed is spread out. And then at this stage I can kind of refine the placement. I might trim something off if I don't think it's nice, if I think it's spoiling the arrangement, but I tend to press things as found. I like that idea, and I do sort of most of the selecting out on the shore rather than in the house, you know. So by the time I've brought it home and brought it into the kitchen, I'm pretty sure that I like it. It's going to make a successful pressing.
And it sticks to that paper really well.
Yeah, so it sticks to the paper. So again, that's what helps too with the arrangement. And then that will just be layered up with cardboard, blotting paper and baking paper. So I put baking paper on top of the seaweed, and that's to stop it from sticking to the layer above. And I just repeat these layers with all of the seaweed until I've got what, you know, I'm happy with, or I've processed all of my seaweed, and then that will go into my seaweed press.
I can't wait to see what your seaweed press looks like. I've never seen one before.
Okay, well, it's very much like a flower press. It works exactly the same way. The one that I've got has been slightly adapted. It's my husband's made holes in it so that there's a little bit more ventilation, because the process is just the same pretty much as drying flowers, but you're getting rid of a lot more water. And if you don't get rid of that water quite quickly, then the whole thing's going to go mouldy. It's sort of two quite thick plywood boards. This is for A3 paper, so it's got six bolts with screws. And you're essentially just making a sandwich, which you're then applying pressure to. So this has already got some seaweeds in it that I've been drying. These are just a collection of shapes and textures that I liked. So we put the top on those to protect those. And then the fresh layer will go on top.
So you're just screwing it together to create the sandwich.
Making a sandwich, yeah, nice and tight. As tight as you can kind of get, really. If I have something like those very large air bladders that I was talking about, I wouldn't press it really tightly straight away. because then they might split or pop. I want them to stay intact but to be compressed, so I will kind of tighten the press slowly over time. So this will feel tight now as I'm screwing it down, and then tomorrow there'll be a bit more room in there because as things dry they shrink. And then it's important that every day for the first week you change all of the wet papers. And then, you know, if it was a hot sunny day in summer, I'd put that in the sunshine for a while, but that'll go by the fire and dry out.
So how long will this take, roughly?
At least 4 weeks, maybe up to 8. You need to really make sure they're really, really dry before you take them out, otherwise they will start lifting and misbehave.
You've got some lovely pieces actually set out here just in front of us, and it's the colour. You know, the colour is amazing. And you don't treat this, do you? This is just what it is naturally.
That's all natural. And these are all from either last spring, summer or the one before. And in fact, this one here is probably about 3 years old, and they've still kept their colour pretty much as bright as they were the day that they were pressed. As long as you keep them dry and out of the sunlight, so in the dark, you know, they will keep their colour. Some better than others. The reds and pink seaweeds tend to fade less than the greens.
And completely different shapes. So, you know, there's one here which looks a bit like it's a giant green feather. It's yes. So delicate.
Yes, so that's a wrack. The stem that you can see is a wrack species, and then growing on it is this, which has got the kind of unfortunate name of gutweed.
Not the most attractive.
No, I think because sort of intestines, I don't know. But it's a feathery, long feathery, bright green strands that have kind of clothed it. It's almost like it's got a wonderful fur coat on.
Have you created anything that you think is your best piece of work with seaweed so far? Can you name one thing?
It's difficult to say. It's not me doing the work. You know, nature's doing the hard work. I'm just displaying it. So, you know, I always sort of feel like I can't take too much credit. You know, I'm not producing these colours or these shapes. I'm just here trying to show them off as best as I can.
And if you're interested in seeing some of Portia's work, you can check out her website at Portia Knight, that's all one word, K-N-I-G-H-T, obviously, .com, PortiaKnight.com.
She popped along to the Aberdeen Art Gallery last year, and mm-hmm. they've got some lovely examples of pressed seaweed from, you know, over 100 years ago. And she says it looks incredible. Just looks still as fresh as the kind of stuff she might put in her bucket today.
Yeah. One of the strangest things I ever found was it was in an antique shop, two sheets of glass together. And originally I thought, what's the point of that, Mary? But if you held it up to the light, someone had managed to capture, and I don't know how many decades before this had been, a spider's web.
Oh,
it was actually trapped between the two sheets of glass. It was nice.
So delicate. That must have been hard to achieve.
Back to the bracing briny of the North Sea and the cold water immersion group called the Aberdeen Baltic Boys. We'd had a really nice chat and I'd run out of questions, and eventually we had to go into the water.
We've got some traditions in the Baltic Boys. We like to get a group photo before we go in.
Right.
And then we get a group selfie before we leave as
right.
well. So we'll get you in that and make sure that you're a Baltic Boy through and through.
Okay then. Well, I have to say, I've got very modest ambitions. What I want to be able to do is to walk in there, duck down, immerse myself, and come back out again. Well, I can't see me swimming at all.
No, that's all you need to start. And that's the thing, is the men's group, you know, typically it's all about, oh, who's in the longest, and that sort of macho attitude is not what we encourage. It's about listening to your own body.
You know, that's interesting. You've got wet boots and gloves.
Yeah, I'm a Jesse.
No, that's right. Yeah. I'm looking to learn. That's
cover the extremities, the bits that you lose most of your heat. I started off in a wetsuit 18 months ago and took me so long to get in and out of it. So I thought, nah, not for that. And then, yes, cut it down to the bare minimum now, and I found that swimming without any neoprene on was too cold. Yeah. Which some guys are in it for that shock therapy, but I like being in for slightly longer and it helps.
Okay.
How are you feeling? Looking forward?
So far, so good. So far, so good. Thank you for asking. We the traditional cue. Come on, boys, suck it in.
Hold the mic.
Yeah, okay, right.
We know who's who. Look
count to three, say
Baltic.
1, 2, 3.
Baltics!
One more time, 1, 2, 3.
Baltics!
Okay, let's see how bad this is.
So, it might feel, when you first go in, your body might start screaming at you, telling you that it's painful or uncomfortable, but the joy of cold water dipping is that you get to master that side of you that wants to seek out comfort.
Okay.
And you get to tell yourself that it'll be worth the rewards at the end.
Interestingly, the water actually feels warmer than the air temperature, and I know it's not.
Yes.
But it feels it just temporarily there.
Yes.
We're up a bit knee level now.
Give it a minute.
It hasn't taken as long as a minute, don't you worry. Right. Oh, right, that's fine. That's my knees beginning to lose all sensation now. Oh. Right. As a novice, boys, I am not going to be brave about this at all, right? I'm going to duck down and run away.
Yeah.
And then change and wait for you on the beach, because that seems to be the sensible thing to do.
There's no shame in that whatsoever. We always say, leave your ego on the beach. If you're in for a minute, then that's brilliant for you. We don't time ourselves, compare ourselves to others.
Good, right.
Right, this is good. Shall we do a shoulder dip?
Yeah, shoulder dip.
Together.
Okay, 1, 2, 3. Oh, right, one more.
How's it feel?
Actually, better now that I've done it.
Yes.
Better now that I've done it. That is just, whoa. Right.
Okay. Well done.
All right, thank you very
well
much.
Done.
Right.
Yay. Yay. Well done, Mark. Oh.
For some reason, it feels harder coming out.
The wind's trying to keep you in today.
It is. It's quite a strong wind. It's kind of pushing us back. Oh. Do you find you miss this if you don't do it on a regular basis?
Yes, I'd say I do. Whether I'm missing the cold water or just the group is the question.
Yeah, it's a good point. Good point. Well,
yeah, because would I come and do it on my own? Probably not.
See, interestingly, most of the times in the past few years I've ever been swimming has actually been by myself.
Right.
You know, and I just go somewhere quiet and what have you and do it. So doing it in a group is unusual for me, you know.
I suppose with a group, there's less concern about the weather. If it's a miserable day, you still turn up because you know the guys will be there.
I was about to ask about that. How much of this is actually having, you know, being part of a group?
About 50-50. I think if it was just you and one person going in, but because it's such a bigger group, it's like, you just go and you make a family out of it. It's like you come on a Sunday and it makes the beach feel more homely. I think that's what everyone needs.
It feels like a family, actually, I would say. It feels like a family. There's a lot of love in the group. I don't want to sound all mushy, but...
It's nicer than a family. It's nicer than a family.
He's got to go home now.
It's the camaraderie, do you know, and when I say, you know, there's great mental health benefits, we don't all sit in a circle and talk about mental health, you know. We're just laughing. We're just laughing for 2 hours straight, you know, before the water, in the water, having coffee afterwards, we're just laughing.
Yeah, I'll be absolutely honest with you, you know. We all went in, you know, and I ducked down a couple of times and I came back out again. And, then, you know, we were standing watching the beach. You were all still in the water. And I was really envious. I thought, you know, I wish physically I could have done it, you know, and I can't at this stage yet. I could probably work up to it, you know, given time, that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of smiling.
Yeah, it's like Matt says, we are just a family just getting on with each other, and there's encouragement all the way through. There's no judgment here. So if you're in for 2 minutes or in for 10 minutes, so long as you're safe and you're enjoying it, that's what it's about. And, we have a good laugh.
I must confess, I probably could have stayed a bit longer. It does feel great, though.
My thanks to all the Baltic boys who let me join their group. They're a thoroughly nice bunch of lads, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I really genuinely enjoyed it. It was a miserable morning. Flat camp sea right up, a miserable morning, and they just made it so much fun.
Yeah,
good.
They sound great. I love that you say that you could have spent a bit longer in the water when you were safely out of the water with your clothes on.
Yes.
Right, time to reveal our mystery sound for the week. Let's have a final listen.
Some wrong answers for a start. Dave in Edinburgh thought it might be a tide rising over seaweed. Debbie Cameron says seaweed being popped underfoot on the beach, breathing its last breath before being pressed. Abby in Abernight says electric fence clicking away gently. And Colin S. in Glasgow, currently in Largs walking the Ayrshire coastal path, thought it might be rain on a field of daffodils.
Quite a few people did get it right, though. Fiona from Innerwick, is it a chick trying to hatch out of its egg? It absolutely is, specifically a lapwing. Liz Morris from Sunny Bologie also got it right, as did Scott and Nadia from Bothwell and Ruth in Edinburgh. She says, at last a sunny morning. I'm also on the swallow lookout. Chiff chaff last week, spring at last.
Yeah.
Ross and Tainalt
says, not going to wait for the usual clue in today's articles. Today's sound is extremely difficult. Could it either be a chick pecking from within the egg before hatching out, or raindrops falling off a roof and hitting a slab or hard surface? You were right the first time, Ross.
John and Nicola in Uchtermuchty and still in bed say, talking of ospreys, a friend of ours from Helensburgh was beside the sea when a sea trout landed at their feet. They could only think it had been dropped by an osprey. They never saw the bird to say thank you, but gratefully took the fish home and ate it. Might the mystery sound be a chick tapping its way out of an egg? Osprey and, even.
Yes, Sandy Young from Houston says, today's mystery sound, a little chick pecking its way out of the egg in time for Easter. Many thanks to all the out-of-doors for a great programme, as always. One last very quick wrong answer. Nigel Balerno says, the resultant static of someone very unwisely untuning the radio from Scotland Outdoors. Who would do that, he asks. That's a very good question. That's it from us, I'm afraid. From all the team here in Aberdeen, thanks for listening.